This is the IBJ podcast for the week of January 11th, 2021. I'm Mason Kings.
Let's get going.
The ball is tipped, and there you are. You're running for your life.
Welcome back to the podcast, everybody, and Happy New Year. Now, that, of course, is the theme song, some would say the love song, of March Madness, the NCAA men's basketball tournament. One shining moment. And as you probably have heard, the city of Indianapolis and the NCAA have hitched their wagons in a big way this year. The city's political, civic, sports, and tourism officials have committed to hosting the entire event, all 68 teams, all 67 games, in central Indiana, and in a very large part, Marion County. Now, although the NCAA said in November it was looking at this as a possible solution for hosting the tournament in the safest and most streamlined fashion possible during the pandemic, they didn't make it official until last week. That gives us about 2.5 months to figure out how to do something that has never been done before, and then hopefully pull it off. It certainly would do wonders for Indianapolis's brand as one of America's great can-do sports and convention cities, and lift up a downtown and tourism sector that have been absolutely hammered by the pandemic. This will require a mind-boggling degree of coordination and cooperation between dozens of organizations, beginning with the city, the state, the not-for-profit Indiana Sports Corp, local tourism and convention officials, national broadcasters, the Marion County Health Department, 3 universities, 6 sports arena administrators and their staffs, all of downtown Indianapolis's hotels, and very likely thousands of volunteers. If they can pull this off, this will be a shining moment that Indianapolis residents and America sports fans will remember for generations. IBJ's Mickey Shuey has been burning up the phones in the last week, getting both the big picture and the fine details of what all this effort will require. He has a story in the latest issue of IBJ, and he is our guest this week. Here's our conversation. I'm pleased to welcome back to the IBJ podcast virtual studio, Mickey Shuey. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you today, Mason?
Great. You know, when I started brainstorming questions about all the logistics involved in staging this event, even I started to get kind of anxious. I don't know if you had that experience when you were reporting the story. I mean, I think about it in relation maybe to hosting the Super Bowl, which was one game in one day, and there's an existing playbook for organizing the nuts and bolts for that event, and Indianapolis literally had years to prepare for that, and now we're trying something that has really never been done during a pandemic in like 2 months. Now you've talked to more than a dozen people in the last week about this. How confident do people sound that this is doable?
I certainly think that there's a lot of optimism about their ability to pull this off because the city's hosted the Super Bowl, because the city's shown its tenacity and its know-how with other major events. I mean, lest we forget that every single year the city hosts the Indianapolis 500, and 200,000-300,000 people. Certainly, as you mentioned, there's a lot more planning, that a lot more time to plan that's there for those types of events. But Indianapolis was preparing for the Final Four this year anyway, so all those gears were already turning. Mm-hmm. This just adds another layer of complexity to that.
In what venues will the games take place? I think there are 6 venues.
Yeah, so there are 6 venues. First is Lucas Oil Stadium, which had originally been slated to host the Final Four. It will still do that. It'll be home to 2 courts, although only one game will be played at a time in that facility. And then you have the Pacers and the Fever's home of Bankers Life Fieldhouse downtown, and then Hinkle Fieldhouse at Butler University, which hasn't hosted a game since 1940, a tournament
game since 1940, yeah.
It's also going to be home to the Indiana Fever over the next 2 seasons as the renovations go on at Bankers Life Fieldhouse. Then you have Indiana Farmers Coliseum at the Indiana State Fairgrounds, which is home of the Indy Fuel and where some other teams play, IUPUI plays. And then you have, for the opening round games, the first round games, you'll have some played at Mackey Arena in West Lafayette. That's where Purdue plays. and then Assembly Hall at Indiana University in Bloomington.
So for the first round games, all six of those facilities that will host games, there'll be 32 games over 2 days. Second round, the same six facilities will host the 16 games. Then for the Sweet 16 and Elite Eight, they narrow it down to the four facilities in Indianapolis proper.
So that seems to be what's going to happen. They haven't really laid out a full plan of what's going to happen where and when, other than to say that the two non-Indianapolis facilities, the Assembly Hall and Mackey, will only host the first round games. But essentially, it seems like what they're getting at is they're going to kind of whittle down the number of venues that are used throughout. My guess is that realistically, we're probably going to see Lucas Oil, Hinkle, Bankers Life, and the Coliseum all host the so-called regionals, the regional championships that you typically get in four cities across the country.
And then the Final Four takes place in Lucas Oil, which is maybe the easiest part because that's the one piece of that they already had planned, although Correct. Not necessarily for this set of contingencies.
Correct. Although we don't know what the setup's going to be for that, so they may change the setup to the big setup that they have for the Final Four, or they might just keep the regional setup where they are going to have two courts. It's really all up in the air right now.
So one of the things I really find interesting is that the city's sports, tourism, and political officials have to graft this massive three-week event into the existing schedules for the city's hotels and its sports facilities and convention facilities. It's like airlifting an aircraft carrier into the Madison Regatta. There already are sports events planned, convention events planned, hotel rooms sold. So my impression is things needed to happen to be able to make room for March Madness. And could you start with the convention center? I thought this was the most interesting.
Sure. So the Indiana Convention Center is considered one of the top tier facilities in the country. And that's in large part because of the relationships that they've been able to build over the years with their conventions and their groups that come in there. And that actually allowed them to work with the conventions that were scheduled for that three-week period and kind of shuffle them around to other parts of the calendar. Now, we don't know what those conventions are. They're not willing to say yet because final contracts have not been signed. But my understanding is that there were significant events that now have to go later into the year in order to make room for this. That's in part because of the city's reputation as a great convention city that they were able to do that.
Yeah, that can't be an easy call to make. I mean, at the end of the year, after you've already convinced somebody, yes, absolutely, have your event in Indianapolis. We're gonna do a great job and it's going to be safe. And then say, oh, we really need to reschedule you.
Absolutely. There's a lot of delicacy involved in that.
And if we weren't clear about this too, the NCAA is going to take the entire convention center. I mean, it's one of the biggest in the country, and they're going to use it for practice courts and meeting areas for the teams. Is that right?
Correct. It's going to be part of a lockdown controlled environment. They're stopping short of calling it a bubble, like what you may have seen with the NHL playoffs or with the NBA regular season and playoffs in Orlando last year. But it really is going to be a controlled environment where only certain people can get in there. Really only the teams and the support staff can get into the Indiana Convention Center during this period for practices and meetings. It'll be closed to the public. From my understanding, it might also be closed to the media because media won't have the same protocols as participants. But it's going to be an environment that, frankly, I don't think that Indianapolis has ever seen for an event, a major event like this.
But what about the venues? Let's take like a Hinkle Fieldhouse, for example, where they, Barry Collier, the athletic director over there, gets a call and say, hey, can you guys help make this happen? What kind of challenges would a Hinkle have, for example, in shifting things around and making this work?
Well, this is the madness that 2020 created in a way, because a lot of the fall sports teams had their seasons bumped to the spring. And that includes volleyball, which plays at Hinkle, and then football and men's and women's soccer, which play at the Selig Bowl directly next to Hinkle. And all of those teams have locker rooms at the Fieldhouse. So he really had to work with the NCAA and in part the county health department to ensure that Hinkle can still be a controlled environment for these games while still allowing access to the teams who need to get in there for Butler.
And we should be clear too about this. I don't believe at this point there are any plans for general admission into these games, that the spectators will be pretty tightly controlled, really maybe to family and whatever kind of, you know, school officials need to be there. Though, is there a chance maybe a couple months from now that the Marion County Health Department would ease up and maybe allow some people in, or would that really just be too much of a bother? I can't imagine they'd want to take that on.
So right now, up to six people per participant, up to six family members per participant can attend the games as long as they are kind of sequestered in their own hotel. All those details are forthcoming. But right now, the focus seems to be on just getting the first 64 games off without a hitch for the NCAA, with the hope that they'll be able to host fans for the Final Four and the national championship game. I have a source telling me that's really the focus of the NCAA's efforts with the health department. Not having fans at the Final Four would really be unprecedented. So they're hoping that they can keep that going and work with the health department. Probably will not be for several weeks that we understand what that could look like, but the health department hasn't said no, but they also haven't really said, yes, we're definitely going to do this yet.
These kind of decisions really do seem to be made, I mean, sometimes with maybe like a week's notice.
Right. Yeah. I mean, with the Colts games, it was usually a week to 2 weeks out. And it should be noted that the Colts were generally allowed to have between 7,500 and 12,500 fans at most of their home games at Lucas Oil Stadium throughout the season. There was a couple at the start that had fewer than that. But with Lucas Oil expected to host the Final Four, that's something to consider.
Earlier, you mentioned hotels. You actually reported this morning at IBJ.com that it's very likely that all of downtown's some 7,600 hotel rooms will be occupied for the tournament, which I'm sure is a huge relief to, you know, hoteliers in Indianapolis. Where are the teams going to stay? If this is going to be a really controlled environment, I assume that they're going to be concentrated in a few hotels.
Well, I'll tell you right now, if you have not gotten a hotel room and you need one for late March, early April, you're probably out of luck if it's supposed to be in the downtown area. Because, as you said, all those hotels are likely to be used. The five main ones for the teams are going to be the JW Marriott, which we know is expected to hold about 26 teams. And then the Marriott.
That's the city's largest hotel. That's 1,000 rooms. Yes. Yeah.
Yep. 1,013 rooms there. You have the Marriott downtown, which is basically right across the street. And that's expected to have about 16 teams. That's the second largest hotel at 650 rooms, I believe. And then you have the Westin, the Hyatt Regency, and Le Méridien. The key about all these is that they're all connected via Skywalk, climate controlled Skywalk, as some would say.
Or gerbil tube, as some of them say.
Yeah, to the convention center, which means that the NCAA would be able to have its heavily controlled environment for all these teams.
Are these teams going to be the only occupants in these hotels? Will it be closed to the public otherwise?
Yes. As per the contracts, we understand that the NCAA is basically buying out each of these five hotels for that three-week period, basically meaning that if a team wins and they advance, they obviously get to stay, but they're not going to be moving into a different hotel with each win or each week. They're going to stay put, and then basically the hotels will not be able to rent out the rest of the rooms in order to maintain that controlled environment.
So if I'm, you know, let's say Duquesne, and I lose in the first round, so I'm gone. Is the NCAA still paying for that hotel room over the next 2 weeks?
Yes, they are. They have a negotiated rate, which is normal with big events. But yes, they've booked the whole hotel. It's closed to public completely, basically, for that three-week period. And only certain people will be allowed in and out.
And the NCAA foots the bill for those hotel rooms.
So the NCAA is going to be footing the bill for this. Typically, they'll do that with any tournament. But obviously, given the complexity of the situation, they didn't want to risk cross-contamination or other people kind of coming inside the bubble or the controlled environment. So really the only way that they could tell the hotels not to rent the rooms is to take them themselves. So there's likely to be a lot of unused rooms downtown that are still paid for, albeit at a lower rate.
And from what I understand, the hotels also be responsible for basically all the food needs of the players are going to have their breakfast, lunch, and dinner for each team in that controlled space. Is that right?
Yes. The JW Marriott, for example, at least with the opening round, they're expecting to make 1,500 breakfasts, lunches, and dinners for the participants, which is just an astronomical number compared to their normal expectations, because even when the hotel's full at 1,000 rooms, not everybody's getting food service for every single meal. So it's a huge undertaking for the hotel, and likely will mean a lot of staffing up and a lot of prep work.
That's a great point about staffing. I mean, a lot of these hotels, you know, are still, if they're operating, you know, with expectations of having what? I mean, 20 to 40% of the rooms filled, if they're lucky. How do they ramp up staffing wise to, at least for a couple of weekends, deal with, you know, a big influx of visitors?
Not to keep going back to JW, but they are at about 30 to 40% of their typical staff, which is 500 people. They're at about 150 now, and they are already starting the process of hiring people, onboarding them. A lot of the people that they're bringing on are actually previous employees that were laid off during the pandemic, but they are starting that process now, and it's likely to continue for the next several weeks, and likely even well into March that they ramp up. The issue is going to be what happens with those staffers when the tournament is over, because those numbers won't be sustainable most likely until probably well into the summer, when conventions are expected to start coming back in full force.
I want to switch over to the Indiana Sports Corp, which is really a major player in all this, but maybe the general public isn't really aware of. Could first explain, I mean, what is their role in this, and what is the Indiana Sports Corp?
Well, the Indiana Sports Corp is the group that was literally created for these big sports events. Certainly, they never really pictured an event quite like this, but the group was created back in 1979. It's the oldest sports commission in the country, and it's really in charge of leading Indianapolis's efforts to bring big sporting events here, like with the Super Bowl back in 2012, with the Pan Am Games, with the World Basketball Championships, you name it. If it's a sporting event in the city, there's a good chance that they're involved.
Is it fair to say that, you know, when Indianapolis is hosting a big event, a big sports event, it's really the Indiana Sports Corp that is hosting the event? I mean, they are really handling a lot of the street level details to make things happen.
Absolutely. They really manage the ins and outs of these events, like the Big Ten Football Championship. They host that event. They put everything together. The Big Ten basically just kind of comes in and fills in the blanks, if you will.
So I'm imagining Ryan Vaughn, who is the president of the Sports Corp, and his team, with the biggest whiteboard they can find, trying to first figure out what they need to know, and then trying to figure out how to accomplish it. What are some of the things on their to-do list that they even can conceive of right now?
I spoke with Ryan earlier this week, and he said, you asked me what still needs to be done. Really, everything needs to be done at this point. They have the hotel contracts in place, but they need to work out the finer details of those. They need to understand the ins and outs of the testing protocols and how teams are going to get from one facility to another, especially the facilities like Mackey Arena or Assembly Hall, where bus transportation will be required. Greeting at the airport, that's going to look a lot different this year than in years past. So they're going to have to figure out how that's going to work, as well as working with the city to determine traffic patterns and road closures, motorcades, things like that. So yes, Indiana Sports Corp is really the point guard on this, if you will. And they're really commanding the team. It's the NCAA's show, but in a way, the Indiana Sports Corp is running it.
One of the things that Indianapolis really seems to do well and sort of likes to boast about is civic engagement. And they're able to, you know, corral sometimes thousands, maybe tens of thousands of volunteers to help big events happen. Generally, a Final Four, I think, requires about 4,000 volunteers. How do they figure out how many volunteers they need for this? And then how do they get all those folks together in less than 2 months?
Yeah, that's perhaps the biggest question mark right now for the Indiana Sports Corp is how many volunteers they'll actually need. Now, getting them is not going to be an issue, as you alluded to. I mean, they have a Rolodex of thousands of people who have worked with them in the past and helped in the past, and many others who are already coming forward and saying, hey, I'd love to be involved in this. So getting the volunteers won't be an issue. As you mentioned, it's going to be figuring that out, and they're really in the early stages of that. And a lot of boxes have to be checked between now and then, including determining whether fans will be permitted at these games. So if they're not, then they'll obviously have a lot fewer people needed. But at the same time, they're still going to need certain things, such as helping direct traffic for media, greeters, and just general hands on deck for whatever they need. So it's going to look a lot different this year, but I don't think they quite know how yet.
What are the next details that we're expected to hear?
The next big thing is probably how Dowtown is preparing for the event. There's a lot of considerations there with beautification and restaurants that are down there, how they engage with this event, because obviously restaurants are like they really rely on big events throughout the year to stay afloat, and they're especially relying on big events to come back now because of the pandemic. The next thing on the NCAA side is kind of charting out exactly how these games will be scheduled and what games are going where. Frankly, I'm very curious what Selection Sunday is going to look like as a lifelong basketball fan. It would be very interesting if they staged it in Indianapolis rather than in the New York studio like they usually do, given that the whole event's going to be here. But those details are still forthcoming. I think that we'll likely learn those details in the next several weeks, but some, such as like the regions, if you will, may not come until a week or two before.
You know, you bring up a good point about scheduling. I mean, all of these games are going to be on TV. And so We have all these broadcast partners, I guess the CBSs and the, help me out with that, the TNTs of the world, who at some point are going to need to know where to put them on the schedule.
That's another big question of bringing in those broadcast partners, your CBS, your TNT, your TBS, your True TV, to ensure that they not only have a good experience, but that they know where they need to be and what their testing protocols are.
Wow. Well, we've got to work that out for us.
Yes.
Both as a city and as a business publication. Hey, thanks so much for your great reporting so far in this, and we'll look forward to the next chapter.
Appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
My thanks again to Mickey Shuey. Again, Mickey has a story in the latest issue of IPJ about everything on Indianapolis's to-do list. And you want to watch on IBJ.com for his continuing reporting this week and as March Madness draws closer. And before you get on with the rest of your week, I do want to point out a few more strong stories from the latest issue. There's a fascinating and business-friendly trend that has come out of the pandemic that's manifesting in central Indiana. Private equity firms have fallen head over heels in love with home service firms like plumbing, heating, and cooling companies. Now, they're not as sexy as tech startups or biopharma outfits, but they have done very well as customers, for the most part, have hunkered down in their homes. IBJ's Anthony Shetley has more on this. Also in this week's issue, John Russell examines the lukewarm reception for Eli Lilly and Company's revolutionary antibody treatment for COVID-19. And Kirk Christian outlines the aggressive plans of Culver's super franchisee Jeff Meyer of Noblesville as he stakes out his new company headquarters and readies for 10 more locations. And again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say it's quite a bit easier to access all the latest news and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.